Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Can't get enough eye-popping, jaw-dropping, heart-stopping reality TV.
It's the best.
Then head to Hey You, home of reality on demand. Stream and download the latest episodes from shows like Keeping Up with the Kardashians and The Real Housewives, same day as the US.
What's more fun than that?
Or binge old faves like The Simple Life and The Hills.
That's hot.
Hey You, reality on demand. Start your 1 month free trial now.
They watch the movies, slash flicks, slash tracks for the good, slash bad. It's the Slash Film Cast for the girls, slash boys, slash old, slash young. Yeah, we watch till the last of the credits is done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Slash Film Cast, the official podcast of SlashFilm.com. I'm David Chen, and with me are
Devendra Hardwire
and Jeff Kanata.
Welcome to the show. Find more episodes of this podcast at slashfilmcast.com. Email us at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. We have a special episode for you folks today. All we're going to do today is talk about Mission Impossible and every single Mission Impossible film.
It's a very possible mission.
It's a very possible mission to talk about this. Yeah, and we're really psyched.
Should you choose to accept to listen to it.
Yeah, that's correct. And the occasion for this is, I mean, there's two occasions. One is that Mission Impossible Fallout is coming out in theaters later this month in July, and it is my most anticipated film of the year. My second most, it's like one of my top most anticipated films. I'm really.
Have you seen those trailers, Dave?
I have not. I've been told the trailers are amazing.
It's basically money shot after money shot.
Nice.
But yeah, those trailers are among the best things I've ever seen. I've seen this year. Yeah. So it is also my most anticipated.
I'm so psyched about getting home from watching the movie and watching those trailers. It's going to be really exciting. And so that's one reason why we're doing this. But another reason we're doing this is because the studio / publicity company promoting studio stuff was able to provide us each with a copy of the 4K UHD discs of the entire Quintilogy. So we have discs one through, or movies 1 through 5 on 4K UHD. And we had a chance to watch all these films this past.
I think these are a new issuing of those, right? It's like a cool. The packaging is all consistent through all 5 movies.
Face is facing the same direction in all of them.
Yes, which is key. You don't want a wrong facing Tom in your library at any point.
No, you don't. That would be terrible. What you're saying sounds terrible.
That's how you know which one is Degray Scott. That's what it
tells. So we got these discs and we're like, okay, well, we want to do a review of these discs because these are fun movies to talk about in general. And so we have a lot to say about them. So let's dive into it. Before we get to that, we want to just thank all the people who donated to the show. Usually we put this in the middle, but since we're going to be just doing all 5 films in succession, let's thank all the donors up top. People who subscribed at the rate of $2 per month, we want to thank Chris Rager, Colleen O'Hara, and Jason Hodges. Thanks so much for donating at the rate of $2 per month. And we got this very lovely email from Miriam from Fraunfeld, Switzerland, who writes in, Dear Slash Filmcast team, I'm donating to you on behalf of my boyfriend Mike, who is going to celebrate his 35th birthday on July 7th. Happy birthday, Mike! We spent the last 8 years together, and you guys have been part of our lives from the beginning. Mike has been a fan of the work of Jeff Kanata since the Totally Rad Show, and so he brought me to listening to the Slash Filmcast. We do not miss a single episode of your show, and you are contributing a lot to our daily life. It is not only your enlightening, profound movie discussions that we appreciate, but also the fact that there are some nice, smart, respectful people like you who love talking about movies and cultural phenomena just like we do. This is, in fact, priceless, and I sincerely thank you for this. And I also thank my boyfriend Mike for all the love and movie knowledge he has given me. By the way, Mike will surpass us all in the summer movie wager. He currently stands at 50 points, username 1LAUCH. Anyway, Dave, Jeff, Devendra, Christy, please keep doing what you do. It is just great. That comes from Miriam from Frauenfeld, Switzerland. Miriam, thanks so much for that lovely message. And we're so glad to be a part of you and Mike's lives over the course of the last 8 years and appreciate the donation. If you want to support what we do here on the Slash Filmcast, if we make a material difference in your life, you can always go to paypal.me/filmcast. That's paypal.me/filmcast. You can also go to slashfilm.com, click on the Slash Filmcast tab, use the PayPal links on the side of the page. All the money you donate does go to help us defray the costs of putting on the show, and we really appreciate it. You guys are awesome. Before we dive into each Mission Impossible film individually, why don't we talk about the franchise as a whole? And overall thoughts on like revisiting this franchise, how we felt when we did it. Jeff Cannata, you have some thoughts?
I do. I mean, it's so rare to be able to watch all of a long series like this back to back in short succession. I almost never do that. And it was such an interesting experience to watch a film franchise that has existed over, what, 20 plus years now? Yeah. And watching all those movies back to back to back like I did. Many of these movies I had only seen, not many, a few of these movies I had only seen once when I saw them in theaters and I hadn't revisited until now. It was a really cool experience watching the entire five film. Well, I actually didn't rewatch the fifth one because it was so fresh in my mind from having reviewed it. But four of the movies back to back, you see Tom Cruise age drastically, and you see the stylistic differences, and you see, I think, a franchise that does a very rare thing, which is finds itself a few movies in and really finds its voice a few movies in. And I thought that was so fascinating to watch. Also, I'm prepared to say, I don't know if you guys agree, and it was very, very apparent to me that the third movie is the best by far.
Not even close.
I really don't know about by far. It is very good.
No, I think the third one is the best.
No. Some people actually think it's the worst of the franchise.
Oh my! Well, that is that's
crazy
insanity.
Talk.
But okay. But let's give our rankings. You know, at some point.
Yeah.
But I think my experience of watching here's my experience of watching this franchise again. Okay, I watched these movies with my wife, and I was talking with her. You know, would randomly point out things during the movie, and I would say things like, oh, hey, like that shot is so cool because it's all CG, and this element was practical, this element was CG, and I realized...
How exhausted was your wife by the end of this, though, Dave?
Like, I realized...
My wife was like, so many Mission Impossibles. God.
Yeah. I realized I had seen these movies so many times.
Yeah, Dave.
And,
yeah.
And the movie director commentaries for every single film. In the franchise.
I do remember in college we would geek out about MI2 quite a bit. I think didn't we see MI3 in the together?
Yeah, I think we saw Mission Impossible 3 together, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, I have seen these movies so many times, and I know intimately how they were made.
Yeah.
And I also could quote virtually every single movie at length. Like, I haven't memorized the entire script
of
every single film.
That's a marketable skill right there.
I haven't memorized the entire script, but it's like so many. Like, I would say, you know, dozens.
Not exactly Shakespeare there, Dave.
How dare you? A, how dare you, Jeff? But B,
what
you know.
What was the Anthony Hopkins line? This isn't Mission Impossible. This isn't Mission Something. This is Mission Impossible.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that.
No, Dave is sitting there with his wife. He's like, okay, this is the part where he says, get down!
You are really underselling how good some of the scripts are in these films, Jeff. So anyway, I love these films, and I agree with you. Seeing Tom Cruise and the franchise evolve has been fascinating, but also seeing the technology evolve, seeing filmmaking styles evolve has been awesome. One of the most interesting things about the series is Tom Cruise produced the first one, and I think he's produced all of them. He used to be with Paula Wagner when he produced. They used to do production together, but the first one was the first movie that Tom Cruise produced ever, right?
Yeah,
and he kind of made it a decision that like this is the franchise that is going to like come to define me in many ways, but it's also a franchise where he's going to allow directors to come in and put their own stamp on it, you know, to kind of be auteurs and make it their own.
And he's made some really smart choices too, of left field choices that I think worked out pretty well.
Yeah, that's just really interesting. He gives also director like with Christopher McQuarrie and J.J. Mm-hmm. Abrams, like these are not necessarily, you know, huge action directors. I don't think J.J. Abrams had made Star Trek at the time.
His first film.
Yeah, it was after TV. Yeah. And by the way, Jeff, it is funny to hear you talk so well of MI3 after your J.J. Abrams slander in our Jedi review. I will not make you forget that, sir. But yeah, what is interesting is clearly Tom Cruise was at home watching Alias every week, like me, and like all of us. Like, I got to get this guy. This guy needs to have my like franchise. Let's just let Bad Robot run everything. And then, yeah, it really found itself, I think. Yeah,
right. He straight up says that in the special features.
Yeah,
he says he was watching Alias at 2 o'clock in the morning one night. And was like, this is the guy.
This guy's a genius.
Yeah, because I guess Tom Cruise doesn't sleep and is always working.
He's a robot.
Yeah, and you know, Brad Bird, episode, you know, the fourth entry into the franchise. Yeah. he had never directed a live action film before.
Yeah.
That, you know, so he's kind of giving people chances, but allowing them to shape the franchise. It's just a really fascinating cultural artifact. These films are right.
I want to mention a couple of other things that stood out to me because I watched these all back to back. First of all, the IMF is a terrible organization.
Yes.
Yes. It is fraught with traitors. It is unbelievable that anyone over and over and over, someone double crosses someone. It's amazing that anything can get done in this organization.
Well, I think it's the entire government structure in this universe. Like Ghost Protocol ends with the spies have all of our drones. End to credits.
Right. I mean, we never even it's totally true. We never even get like you know, a movie where the IMF is working on all cylinders.
Yeah.
You know, it's literally every movie is, well, this time the IMF is blown all to smithereens, and it's like every time the IMF is screwed from the inside out.
One of my favorite articles about Mission Impossible is by Eric Lundegaard. It kind of changed the way I look at these movies. It's entitled Mission Impractical. And he says here, he watched the first two Mission Impossible films. This article came out many years ago, and he says, the ending to Mission Impossible 1 doesn't say something cynical about the spy game. The entire series says something cynical about the spy game, because the main message of Mission Impossible movies is this: we need IMF agents to protect us from IMF agents.
Exactly.
You know, like,
you should,
the villains from the first three films, and we should say we're going to spoil all the Mission Impossible films, not including Mission Impossible Fallout, the new one. But the villains from the first three films are IMF agents, right? Or IMF operatives or something like that.
And,
you know?
And the first film like completely breaks the show too, because like when the IMF was a well-running organization, Jim Phelps was our guy. And the first movie just kind of retconned him as it turned him into a guy who was tired of it all and a traitor.
Right,
which is kind of amazing.
In this article, too, it says, like, Jim Phelps dies in Mission Impossible 1, and he says, Eric Lundegaard says, that's like killing off Mr. Brady 10 minutes into the Brady Bunch movie, you know?
And making him, like, a serial killer, too. Like,
right.
he is the villain, and then, he dies.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The other thing that I noted, maybe you guys were already aware of this, but I was not, how there is a nod to the first film's iconic horizontal 2 inches above the ground suspended in the air thing in all of them.
They all
have that moment. I was not aware of that until noticing
I'm pretty sure that's how Tom Cruise gets up in the morning, like, just to remind himself.
Yeah, I mean, right. Jeff, if you've watched the movies 10 times each like me, you would have recognized this a long time ago. So,
well, I'm not the impossible super fan that you are, Dave, but
indeed.
I'm becoming. I enjoyed all these movies. I'm a Tom Cruise fan. I'm a big fan of this series. But again, I don't have the compulsion that perhaps you do.
Don't know what you're talking. I think it's completely healthy, my association with this.
Also, and this isn't a fault of the movies. This is a fault of the property earlier than this. How does anyone get anything done if every time you have a mission, people can choose to accept it or not?
I think it's kind of like a rhetorical thing. Pretty like your mission, like, you choose to accept it, but you're gonna accept it. You know? Yeah. What
well,
saying?
I guess, but why even say it then? Like, you know, the reason we have a military is so people don't get a choice whether to accept a mission. Like, is the plan like, you know what? I'm not gonna do this one. They just keep going out to more IMF agents until somebody takes it. You know, it's like, oh, nobody's accepted it yet.
It's kind of like Jeff. It's kind of like at weddings. Like, if you know, if you have any problem with this union, like, speak now, forever hold your peace.
Right.
It's like you don't expect anyone to actually say something, but it's like a tradition. You know what I mean?
It's, I feel like your Uber drivers, like, it just keeps going to the next agent, basically. Like,
I do want to say a word about these discs before we get going with the actual films themselves. First of all, the discs look awesome in 4K. I think they all look spectacular. They sound amazing. A quick word about special features.
HDR also?
Yeah, HDR is amazing. A quick word about special features, which is that the special feature situation is pretty rough. Like, I don't think there are any new 4K special features as far as I know.
And the special features get better as the series goes on because it seemed like they cared more. But the first movie special features are actually made me angry. Straight up made me angry. Because there is a sequence that I wanted to find out how they did the train sequence.
Yeah.
And there's a special feature called the train sequence. And I put it on and it was like, the train sequence was so crazy. We wanted to do something you've never seen before. Yeah, Tom Cruise. Yeah. We wanted to do something you've never seen before. Yeah, Brian De Palma. I just wanted to do something you've never seen before. And then they cut to a shot of people, you know, behind the scenes on set at ILM, and a guy with a bullhorn, he's like, all right, here we go. And 3, 2, 1, action. Cut to black, credits.
That's every 90s special feature, by the way, except for The Matrix.
Yeah. So
no new information here.
Most of the 4K discs have a commentary on them that's borrowed from the Blu-ray copy.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Blu-rays have all the special features on them. Now, there is one benefit of this set, which is a couple of the films have retail. When they first came out on Blu-ray, they had retail-specific special features. So if you bought it at Target, you'd get a different set of special features than if you bought it at Walmart or Best Buy. And that sucks. Like, that's just terrible. However, many of the like in Ghost Protocol or Rogue Nation, I think there were some retailer-specific special features. In the 4K Ultra HD set, you get all the special features. So you get all the Target, all the regular, you know, like, all the special features, but they are on the Blu-ray. So I just want to point that out, that, like, they are on Blu-ray. They're not, like, 4K special features, but you
just
do get all of them.
A whole new format for that. Yeah. Amazing.
So that is cool. It gives users or consumers a reason to kind of re-up on the 4K, is you don't need to deal with those stupid retail-specific special features.
Right.
But overall, I mean, the set looks amazing, not just, like, the movies themselves, but also just, like, the outside of the set looks amazing. It looks good on the shelf. You know what I mean? I think
we were talking about how much pressure this puts on them to put out the sixth movie in this exact same form factor and design, so that you don't have like five awesome, you know, beautifully designed matching set, and then this sixth movie like, I'm sitting here like a sore thumb.
Was that like Seinfeld theme song just now? What was that?
Agreed.
I really hope Mission Impossible Fallout like matches this when it comes out on 4K.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah,
it really is.
We'll see if it does.
And a lot of people have been asking, by the way, like, should they upgrade to the set, fans of the franchise? And I do think it's worth it, especially for the earlier movies. Like, some of those early Blu-rays are pretty rough, and I think the remasters looks good. The HDR mix is really interesting too, and I'll talk about that specifically in some of the movies, but it really brightens up Mission Impossible 1 and 2, and I'm honestly worried about how older movies are getting the HDR treatment, and it seems pretty well done here. So definitely worth a buy. Maybe not all at once. Maybe just, like, you know, buy it piecemeal.
You do have the option of buying them one by one as well.
Yeah. I'm surprised there's no, like, real box or anything, you know. Yeah. That would have been fun.
I'm also wondering about the status of the box and whether there's ever going to be a box or whether there's going to be a Fallout, you know, matching the box set. Here's one thing that's kind of irritating if you're an anal retentive pedant such as myself, is the Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, they are called MI4 and MI5 on the boxes.
I love it. Yep. Love that.
That's never what their names were.
But as they should be, though. That they did that. Yes.
It's just too confusing.
It's like Live, Die, Repeat all over again, guys. They changed the title after the movie came out. Okay.
You always knew the order when you put it on your shelf. That's
you don't
all.
Go, did the protocol come before the falling out or the what?
Again, Jeff, if you've seen the movie a bunch of times, there's no question about the order. So,
It's so much more beautiful when you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
That is true.
Like,
I'll give you that. I'll give you that. Yeah. But if you're a purist, I mean, this is like the Star Wars special editions of Mission Impossible boxes. You know what I'm saying? Okay. All right. Guys, let's dive into our thoughts on Mission Impossible 1.
Good morning, Mr. Phelps. This is your mission should you choose to accept it. Should you or any member of your IM force be caught or killed, the Secretary will disavow all knowledge of your actions. Ethan Hunt will be your point man, as usual. Good luck, Jim.
Simple game. Is he serious?
Always.
It's much worse than you think.
We're being ambushed. Abort, that's an order. They knew we were coming. Do you read me?
I don't care how he did it. I want to know why he did it.
You're worried about me. Why you survived?
I'm sure we can find something I have that you need.
These guys are trained to be ghosts. Let's not waste time chasing after him. Just make him come to us. Find something that's personally important to him, and you squeeze.
This movie came out 22 years ago. As I mentioned, Tom Cruise's first produced movie. It was directed by Brian De Palma. I'm going to read the plot summary from IMDb. An American agent, under false suspicion of disloyalty, must discover and expose the real spy without the help of his organization. So, was very curious to see how this movie had aged. The technology has not aged very well, but everything else about this movie is awesome, in my opinion. I still think this movie really works. And what's interesting about it is not really an action film. It's barely a spy film. It's much more of like a psychological thriller, in my opinion.
It's a noir. It's a straight up noir thriller.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's slow paced.
Yep.
It feels old to me. It feels very
like
old.
Robert
school.
Towne co-wrote this movie. Don't forget. You know, and it shows. Like, this has that nice, slow Chinatown vibe or something.
For sure.
Yeah.
And it's funny to compare this to where we are now, which is like, you know, balls to the wall, action, set piece. This movie has an action set piece or two, but the first half is like this very slow-paced, starkly lit, noir, romance-y kind of strange you know, it feels like it was shot on a set kind of on purpose. Everything's in tight close-ups, like an
Dutch
old
angles, like low angles. You know, it's all really very stylized.
Yeah. It's a very different film than what the franchise ended up becoming.
Yeah.
And all of the movies are different from each other, but I think this one feels the most different to me.
Agreed completely. And I think it still really works. I think the score by Danny Elfman is awesome. And I think it has a really good mix of these thriller elements. And also, it does have some balls-to-the-wall action. That final set piece with the train, the TGV, bullet train is like still holds up,
it's
in my
incredible.
Opinion. Right? I mean,
it's
all good. I mean, for the most part, the CG, you know, it's a little bit rough, but I'm still convinced that they actually did something on a train, you know, like
if that was shot now, Tom Cruise would literally have been on top of a bullet train. They would have actually done it.
Like, Tom, no, not this one.
It's also a movie that was made in 1996, and it is so 96, man.
Yeah.
It's so fun looking back and seeing the internet search engine scene. And like, there's a moment that I wrote this line down. Ving Rhames talks about like
the computers, right?
The most high end computer that you can think of, the one that isn't on the market yet, but he can get his hands on because he's so badass.
Yeah,
and he goes, it's It's a 686 prototype with AI RISC processor. Dude, the 686, you guys.
The 686. Amazing. Meanwhile, like the iPhone like 2 had that, you know.
Oh, man. This like, movie does feel like it's the first time Brian De Palma ever saw a computer. Dude, just like the way that whole research scene is shot and everything, like it is kind of amazing.
I will give the film – I should say there was no iPhone 2. It's just the iPhone 3G. But I will give the film credit for this, Devendra. The tech in this entry is like I don't even know if it was like well done back then, but
it's not a good look at like BBSs and how those things work.
But it's at least acknowledges that like Usenet groups exist. You know what I mean?
It isn't embarrassingly bad. Like they didn't invent something that the internet never would be. Like a lot of movies did at that time.
That's exactly what I'm saying. It's exactly what I'm saying.
But I have to say, like having just rewatched Sneakers too, it is funny how much this movie owes to that.
Mm-hmm.
I think quite a bit. And the tech there was amazing, as we talked about a couple weeks ago. There's so much going on here. What's interesting about this movie too, it doesn't even feel like a mid-90s movie, guys. This movie feels like a 70s movie. It feels like something like people well De Palma and Robert Towne, like this is the old guard of Hollywood making a big blockbuster movie in the mid-90s, and even then it felt really weird and different, because you look at like Mission Impossible 2 and like that is a lot of 90s action. That's like peak 90s action. Yeah. And this movie was even weird back then. I hadn't watched it since the 90s, so it was really fun revisiting it. It really holds up. I don't know, like for me, I think maybe some of the pacing is a little too much at some points. Like just get to it, guys. We know what you're trying to do. But yeah, it still holds up. It's really fascinating to watch right now.
So I'm not sure I agree 100% with how well it holds up. I think it's fun and it still has a lot of great stuff in it, but it felt a little old to me. Just pacing wise. And it's funny too, because we find Tom Cruise at the beginning and he's like this young hotshot kid who's just like palling around with people. And it's such a funny way to introduce the Ethan Hunt, who becomes, you know, this wizened old, experienced MI agent.
He's a mythological figure by the final movie, you know, most recent.
But yeah, I disagree. I think it holds up really well. And I think like this psychological drama, this kind of mind game that Mr. Phelps's wife is playing with Ethan Hunt really works, in my opinion. Like you really understand why he would be willing to jeopardize everything for, you know, for knowledge of whether or not Claire, played by Emmanuel Béart, is a traitor. And that is the heart of the film. As Jim Phelps says at the end, he says, you ask the question, but you yourself are the answer. And I think that whole relationship and the kind of simmering romance between them really worked for me. I actually remember this is, you know, Reddit launched a new subreddit this week called Not in the Movie. And is it Not in the Movie? It's a subreddit where people talk about shots from the trailer for the film that didn't make it into the final film. And this is one of my first experiences with that, because there was like in the trailer, it's called Reddit's R Not in the Movie. It's an awesome subreddit. I love it. And this is one of my first experiences of experiencing like a scene in the trailer that wasn't in the movie. There was like a love scene between Ethan Hunt and Claire that never made it into the film. Mm-hmm. Instead in the movie, it's only hinted at that there is something going on between
your
the two.
Teenage self feels betrayed.
Yeah. It's felt completely betrayed that I didn't get to see a love scene on screen. Anyway, I think it holds up much better than Jeff Kanata is saying. And, I really appreciate it. Also a couple of random things to point out. One is that this was during a time when they dressed up in masks, like the masks were often actually masks.
Yeah.
Or specifically that one time at the beginning. No, two times, I think. Once in the very opening and then when they go to the party. So that was very interesting. I remember at the time, I still remember I was like a teenager when this movie came out, people complaining so much about how convoluted this plot was. Right? And how
well, it's a crazy way to do the film version of a new franchise, because they spend about 10 minutes trying to establish how the IMF works.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then completely like undermine it, mess with it, try to, you know, show you how screwed up it goes from that norm. But we barely got a sense to even understand the norm before everything goes haywire. So, right. You know, it feels like a second or third film in a franchise rather than a first.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think
everybody saw the TV show. Yeah.
Well, it was really confusing because, you know, first of all, I think the storytelling and how confusing it is like nothing compared to what people are used to following these days. I mean, like, this movie has nothing on, like, a single episode of Westworld. Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of how much people are expected to follow. So I think it's just a sign of changing times and how people consume media. But I also do think there were some, like, genuinely confusing moments in this movie when I first watched it.
Yeah.
Particularly the scene when Ethan Hunt meets Jim Phelps at the train station. And he's kind of, like, replaying in his mind how Jim Phelps murdered everyone. Oh, it's beautifully shot and edited, but at the time I had no idea what the heck was going on. Like, I remember when I watched this.
He's playing along with Jim Phelps, the live version.
Correct.
But we see him in his head putting together the real version.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and that's a hard concept to sell, but it's a brilliant concept to try to convey in a scene. And the way that scene is all shot, like underneath their faces, and it's so wild.
Amazing sequence. But yeah, I remember the first time I watched it when I was a kid, I was like, I have no idea what is happening. You know, like it was very confusing to me back at the time.
Because you're seeing something that is direct contradiction to what you're hearing them say. And it's
not only that, but when he's like flashing back, he's like flashing back multiple times to be like, oh, did it happen this way? No, it didn't. Yeah, it could have happened this way. You know, like he's not even recounting, like the flashbacks aren't even necessarily absolute truth. You know what I mean?
Right.
It was pretty crazy and like very complex storytelling for what was ostensibly an action film at the time. But I love it now. Like looking back on it, watching it again, I really love it. So
mm-hmm. that last scene on the train where we find out, you know, everybody's revealed and all the betrayals are out in the open. I mean, it's shot like the freaking Maltese Falcon. It's like swaths of light across eyes, but everything else is in shadow. Yeah. And I mean, it's such an old school kind of movie.
Agreed.
It's very, very interesting to see it now.
Yeah. Any other thoughts? I do want to point out that like this is a movie where, like, in my opinion, I had not had much experience with Mission Impossible, the TV show. My parents watched it a lot, and they were big fans.
My dad loved the show, man.
Your dad, you said?
Yeah.
My understanding of one of the appeals of the TV show is it's about everyone working as a team. You know, it's about like everyone has their own little function and they're all working as a team to make this extremely insane thing happen. And you really get that in the first part of this this movie. Is like, oh, everyone's function is like, this is what the movie's going to be like. You know, I'm watching
this. And Emilio Estevez is in this?
Yeah, Emilio Estevez. And then almost instantly everyone is killed off. And and then like Tom Cruise has to cobble together this like a secondary team.
And this is why one of the things that I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, like, I think that's what Mission Impossible 2 completely did away, really. I mean, Ving Rhames and the other guys in the movie, and they're kind of working as a team, but really, it completely did away with the idea of this being a team kind of thing, and Tom Cruise is just like action star. And that's what I think Mission Impossible 3 did a really good job of, is it restored this idea of these people like working as part of a team, you know, and like, and that's a concept that I think has kind of stayed with the franchise since Mission Impossible 3. But you see a glimpse of it at the beginning of this film. Anyway, Jeff Kanata, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the exact thing, and I that is why I favor the latter films in this franchise over the earlier ones, because I think Mission Impossible 1 and 2 were trying to be James Bond, and I think that's the wrong way to approach this franchise. I think it found its way. Even 3 is much more a James Bond movie than 4 and 5 are. And by 4, we really are like – I mean, the whole plot of 4 is like we need to constitute a new team. Here's the team. And it's all about team. And like Tom Cruise has that whole speech at the end about how like I couldn't have done it. We couldn't have done it without unless we were working together. And it really finds its footing as a movie about component parts that are all essential. And mm-hmm. that's when I think this franchise for me is the most fun, because they're basically heist movies, but the heist is this, you know, crazy mission. It's not necessarily stealing something, although sometimes it is, but it's, you know, it's this clockwork interconnected. You have to do something over here while I do something over there that I find to be the most fun. And the movies that do that the best are the ones I tend to enjoy the most.
Totally. Yeah, most definitely. I totally agree with you, Jeff. I do want to say though, like I wouldn't call the first Mission Impossible Bond-like, because there's very little, even like the older, like the Connery Bond films, like this has a different vibe altogether. This is like you turn Chinatown into a spy film. It is a really specific 70s thriller vibe. There's a lot of paranoia going on there. Mission Impossible 2, though, is straight up what Bond was doing in the 90s. And that is, yeah, that's a fun thing to talk about now.
Yeah.
Couple of other things I want to point out. One is Vanessa Redgrave is in this movie as Max, and she is awesome.
So good.
Like her kind of extremely flirtatious relationship with Tom Cruise is hilarious. Henry Cherney, awesome character actor. You're going to see him in Sharp Objects on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
And I am bummed that he was not in the franchise after this. I mean, I thought he was an awesome presence that was like kind of Tom Cruise's nemesis in this film. And I just love his kind of line deliveries. It's very like deadpan, very understated. And it sounds like he's irritated at all times. And I just thought he brought a lot to the character of Kittredge in this movie. Finally, I wanted to mention the like kind of central action set piece in this movie. Not the train, but the getting into the CIA thing, right? The iconic shot of him like splayed out on the ground, like an inch away from the floor. And I mean, I think that sequence really summarizes everything that makes Mission Impossible great and terrible at the same time, right? It's great because you have Tom Cruise, hanging off increasingly improbable things as the series goes on in order to entertain millions of people in the audience. But it's terrible because it's so ridiculous that the CIA would use these like extremely dumb things to protect itself. I mean, you're going to have like pressure sensitive floor, but not just turn off the computer. Do you know what I mean? It just with even the mildest
put a password
scrutiny,
on it.
Yeah.
You know, like, how long it takes to boot up a computer in 1996.
It's true. It's true.
But with even the mildest of scrutiny, you know, that you can, it doesn't really make much sense. That being said, the sequence is really well shot. I mean, I still remember that scene of like when Tom Cruise is pulled up to the top really quickly by Jean Reno and the floor changes color behind him and the knife falls. You know, it's just so many amazing moments.
I love the idea that this place is locked down. Even if you breathe too hard,
yes,
alarms go off. But a fucking rat is just running through the, you know, like that rat's not going to cause the alarms to go off every day.
Yeah.
But anyway, you know, it is a great sequence. And the way Jean Reno is like shaking and trying to hold him is like, these guys didn't have a better plan than you'll just hold on, you know, as long as I'm down there.
Yeah.
But also the thing that I love about Mission Impossible, the concept of Mission Impossible is the scene where they go, here's the thing. It's got pressure sensitive lights.
Yeah.
If you fart, it'll know. If a thousand armed troopers, a parade constantly around it. There's hot lava on both sides, you know, a team of robot dogs are perched precarious, you know, that scene where they talk about how impossible this is and then they do it. Like that's to me what's so fun and why I'm so pissed at Mission Impossible 2, because it didn't have that at all.
All right, let's move on, guys, to our discussion of Mission Impossible 2.
Agent located. Identity confirmed.
Good morning, Mr. Hunt.
Sorry I barged in on your vacation.
Well, Mr. Hunt, I don't quite know where to begin.
You know me?
No.
should I?
She's got no training for this kind of thing.
But to go to bed with a man and lie to him, she's a woman. She's got all the training she needs.
Welcome to Australia, mate.
This ain't funny.
The mother of all nightmares is on the loose.
I don't think I can do it.
You mean it'll be difficult?
Very.
Well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park for you.
So Matt Singer wrote a piece recently. Did you guys see this at screencrush.com?
Uh-huh.
He published it like a couple days ago. It's a coincidence. But he basically says, like, it's time to stop bashing Mission Impossible 2, an underrated movie. What is it? Hold on. An underrated action movie, right, is what he says here. And he makes a few points. He says, number one, Mission Impossible 2 is the movie where Mission Impossible became the franchise we love. Point two, it has the franchise's best use of the Mission Impossible masks. Point three, it is a sneaky good John Woo movie. Point four, the plot hinges on every man on planet Earth instantly falling in love with Tandy Newton, a concept Fair. That is extremely plausible. Yes. And point five, Tom Cruise's hair is magnificent. So that's his argument.
No, it's a movie about Tom Cruise's hair.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, totally. Totally. But guys, I mean, here's the thing about Mission Impossible 2. It's terrible, in my opinion.
It's terrible.
It's very bad.
Terrible.
But I love it.
Dude, I loved it at the time. I remember my roommate and I at the time went so crazy for this movie because we saw it in college. And we were such John Woo nutballs. And we were so excited that he was doing this movie with Tom Cruise. And we thought the motorcycle sequence was so amazing.
Yes.
And all the flight sequences were so amazing. Mm-hmm. And I watching it this week, I was like, this movie is straight up bad.
Yeah, it's a bad
movie.
I remember watching the special features for this movie, Jeff Cannata, and there is a scene where Tom Cruise is like, you know, if you look at the script of this film, I mean, it's just so good. And then right after that, it shows a scene with Tom Cruise interacting with Tandy Newton's character, and he's like, well, would it make you feel better if I told you that I didn't want you to go? And she's like, yes. And he's like, well, then feel better.
You
know, I remember thinking at the time I was watching that special feature, like, I don't know how good the script is. You know?
Yeah.
I don't know if I believe Tom Cruise that it's like really good.
Also, surprising, Robert Towne, still screenwriter,
Well,
wrote this movie. Too,
here's the thing about this movie's script. It does have the best line in the entire Mission Impossible franchise.
Yes.
Right? Which is when Anthony Hopkins, who's playing Ethan Hunt's boss, says, Mr. Hunt, this isn't mission difficult, it's mission impossible. Difficult should be a walk in the park for you.
So good.
That is a great line. Yeah. Yes.
And if anybody other than Anthony Hopkins says it, it could sound really dumb, but he makes it sound so good.
Yes. Good. Yes.
Also, by the way, story credits for this movie always gives me like a little nice geek thrill to see, because it's Ronald D. Moore, who gave us, you know, Battlestar eventually, and Brandon Braga, like two Star Trek guys, delivered the story for this movie. And the story is terrible. Like, whatever is going on in this movie is ridiculous. So I like bad movies that find a little fun sometimes. Like that line, you know, like it's very self-aware in that.
The courtship via speeding car
slow
crash
motion
on cliff,
speeding car. Yeah.
I mean, the tale is old this time. Yeah.
It is. It's basically fucking while in cars, I guess.
But this is what happens when you give John Woo, you know, a huge, huge franchise. And I honestly was also obsessed with this movie when I was in high school, because I watched a lot of action movies and I watched a lot of John Woo movies. And it was really cool to see people, you know, that I was going to school with also being excited over this thing, because I knew I was watching John Woo at the time and I could like geek out about certain little things. I dreaded rewatching this movie because I've tried a couple times recently. It just never really happened. But honestly, once you get past the hump of that first act, which is mostly dialogue, like it's sort of like
mostly
Attack of
them Clones. Humping.
Yeah,
yes.
Mostly them humping. But once you get past a lot of that, and just like the visual poetry of it, like, yeah, that car chase is completely improbable, but damn, is it beautiful. There are so many great things and great ideas. That shootout in the lab where, you know, we have Tom Cruise dual pistoling it like Chow Yun-Fat. And it just, so much of that looks good. Even the motorcycle stuff, like it is, there's wildly inventive and really cool action going on here, even if like the stuff around it is, you know, is kind of trashy. But I've rewatched a lot of, you know, 90s schlocky action movies, and compared to a lot of them, this one honestly holds up. Like compared to the later Brosnan James Bonds, I'd watch this any day.
I think I want to take a moment to talk about how wildly successful these first two films were, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to read from Wikipedia for Mission Impossible 1. Mission Impossible opened on May 22nd, 1996 in 3,000 theaters, the most ever up to that point. And it broke the record for a film opening on Wednesday with $11.8 million. The film also set house records in several theaters across the United States. Mission Impossible grossed $75 million in its first 6 days, surpassing Jurassic Park, and took in more than $56 million over the four-day Memorial Day weekend, beating out the Flintstones. Cruise deferred his usual $20 million fee for a significant percentage of the box office. The film went on to make $180.9 million in North America and $276.7 million in the rest of the world for a total of $457.6 million. But Mission Impossible 2, guys, was even more successful than that. I mean, the film grossed $57 million in its opening weekend and held the number one spot for 3 weekends when Mission Impossible 2 came out in 2000.
It's a different time.
The film eventually grossed $215 million in North America and $330 million in other territories, totaling $546 million worldwide, the highest grossing film of 2000. So regardless of how insane and ridiculous it was, these were amazingly successful movies.
Yeah.
And also movies that had a ton of cultural impact. I mean, I think Mission Impossible 2, that Ben Stiller parody, is almost as well known as the movie itself. And I think this movie did give us a ton of iconic Mission Impossible imagery. I mean, the kind of free climbing with no safety gear at the beginning of this film, that is still impressive today, in my opinion.
I think that's the best part of the movie. I honestly think it never reaches those heights again. For me, now,
literally.
Nowadays.
Literally.
Yeah, I think that is the coolest imagery, the coolest idea of him doing that. The way it's shot is spectacular. The cool sunglasses to throwing them right at the camera to having them explode, all that stuff. It's so John Woo, but so awesome. And I don't think the movie ever gets back there for me anymore.
We have to talk, before we move on to Mission Impossible 3, we have to talk a little bit about Dougray Scott, right?
Because, my God, what a sad story.
well, okay. So here's the thing, is he was supposed to be cast as Wolverine in X-Men 1.
Yeah.
And he couldn't do it because he was working on Mission Impossible 2. Now,
my understanding was he had a decision to make. Which movie was he going to take? They were shooting at the same time, and it was either play the villain in the sequel to the smash hit successful Tom Cruise film. You're the second lead, basically, in a Tom Cruise sequel to this movie that was a huge smash success, or play this comic book character in a genre that doesn't work. For a director that did The Usual Suspects,
right?
It seemed like a no-brainer.
It seemed like a here's the thing. I bet everyone who worked on this movie did really well. You know, like, I think that they all made a ton of money off this movie. It was wildly successful. I think they're okay. But at the same time, I mean, everyone knows who Hugh Jackman is. And that guy, he appeared in, what, like 15 movies as Wolverine? It became one of the defining characters of our age in terms of cinema. And no one knows who Dougray Scott is anymore, really.
But I can't imagine anybody would have given him the advice to take the Wolverine part over. It's a no-brainer. It's money in the bank to be in the Tom Cruise movie, and you feel like it's going to catapult your career into the stratosphere. And this comic book movie where it's silly, you're dressed up in tights,
you
and your
knives coming out of your fists.
Yeah, what is that even about? No one's going to remember that in 2 years. It just feels like.
Here's the question, right? Is if Dougray Scott had taken X-Men, would he be the greatest showman today? Right. Is the question. But. Let me ask you, what did you think of his performance? I thought it was deliciously hammy. You know,
he's so much fun.
It's extremely cheesy, extremely evil, and I mean, I still some of his line readings are so over the top. Like, how about dying? and making me a lot of money. You know, like, I still, like, it's just, it is hilarious how over the top it is. And I appreciate it for what it is, which is like a comic book style villain character.
I think he's a great villain, honestly. And compared to, like, I just rewatched Ghost Protocol, and I love everything about that movie except that vanilla ass villain. Like, it is.
Yeah, he is.
There's just nothing.
There's a moment at the end of that movie where a mask comes off and it's him, and you're like,
yeah.
Him.
After the end of the desert chase, and I'm like, okay, cool. I guess that's interesting.
Yeah. Him? Oh, him. Okay.
This guy, he's evil. He's smarmy. He's evil. Like, from that opening scene, too, like, he just exudes evil. Speaking of the Wolverine role, like, I'm very glad we got Hugh Jackman instead of him. Like, it's just a completely different swagger and energy.
I think the way they handle him as an IMF agent is really weird in this movie. Like, like Anthony Hopkins is like, Dougray Scott, this guy was supposed to double you.
You were on vacation.
You were on vacation, so we had him double you, and he completely Sean Ambrose betrayed the organization and put the world health in jeopardy to steal this virus. And we're just not going to talk about that again. You know, it's just completely unacknowledged.
They couldn't afford to get Anthony Hopkins back. You know, he had to do that one scene. Well, I just mean
they didn't even this is a major infiltration of IMF ranks that they're just like, oh, well, it happens.
After the first movie, it does
happen all the time.
Yeah. They're used to it.
Yeah.
I remember the critic. Either the web series reboot of The Critic, I think, made direct fun of this movie. And the skit was literally Anthony Hopkins delivering one line and just give me my money now. that's what he feels like in this movie.
Yeah.
There's a couple of things I want to point out that actively kind of made me angry rewatching this movie.
Please.
The first is the motorcycle sequence, which I was really anticipating because I remembered loving it.
Yeah.
It's not good. And there's a moment where Tom Cruise is on foot. The motorcyclist who is tracking him down jumps over him, and Tom Cruise shoots the person off the motorcycle from underneath. And it is so preposterous and goofy that I was
so good.
No,
yeah,
no,
you just described 18 John Woo movies, Jeff.
Yeah, I know,
and I love them all.
Yeah.
The point in that chase where he does the I'm just gonna put my feet on the ground to avoid getting shot, that makes no sense, but it's such a John Woo logic thing. I'm like, this is a beautiful action movie stupid thing. I love it.
The other moment that got me actively angry, and I know that I think this was even one of the points you brought up as to why the movie is underappreciated, but it's straight up dumb, is the big reveal at the end that he put the mask on the guy with the duct tape over his mouth.
Yep.
Because the biggest gift that Mission Impossible 3 gave to this franchise is retconning the mask tech to being something that's based in reality and not dumb and goofball-y. But this movie leans so hard into goofball. Like, the idea of him beating somebody up, putting duct tape on their mouth, and then administering very realistic.
He had the machine right there. It's like a portable mask making machine.
What I wouldn't give for the scene where he's putting the mask on an unwilling recipient and able to put it on in such a effective way that it becomes pitch perfect, picture perfect.
Completely seamless. I loved Face Off in the 90s too. So to me, it was this is just seeing him go crazy with that concept in a Mission Impossible. I just found that hilarious. But does not make sense. I like how in Ghost Protocol they even build up the masks and it just doesn't really happen.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant that they do that and then don't do it. But the best thing is in 3 when it's like, okay, well, let's give you a little, let's Batman begins this a bit and explain how it could be.
Indeed. Any other thoughts on Mission Impossible 2, or shall we move on?
I mean, I kind of forgot this was a pre-Westworld movie too, in a way, so that was fun.
Yeah, because you got Anthony Hopkins and Tandy Newton in the movie.
And Tandy Newton. And I think Tandy Newton, the dialogue is not good in this movie, but I think everybody really does a good job of selling their role. And I think Tandy Newton as the sultry thief, she is quite good. Dougray Scott as super evil guy, even his henchman who has a weird obsession with Dougray Scott's character and is jealous of him. I love all this because I think they each exude that. It is, you watch this movie as a silent action movie, basically, and I think it works really well.
I think it's by far the worst of this series.
But, I agree.
It's very bad.
It's very bad. but here's the thing. I don't disagree with anything Matt Singer wrote in his article. You know, I thought all those points are correct, but at the same time, it's still a bad movie that's aged very poorly. So, you know.
It may be one of those you had to be there movies too. Like, I can't imagine somebody who didn't have that like kernel of love for this movie can go back and rewatch it and find something. But who knows?
This is definitely the definition of one of those movies that you're like embarrassed to go back to.
Well, I remember when I watched this movie. It's time. It's so of its time. Yeah. It was so on the nose of what was cool at that time, and that's why I remember thinking it was so cool, but it just doesn't age well at all.
I still remember coming home from the theater watching this film and thinking how amazing of a time I had at the theater. And then looking back on it, you're like, wow, that's awful.
The crowd loved it. Yeah. I watched this movie several times during high school, and people loved it. It was a great crowd experience. I watched all these movies with my family, too, not in the theater, but we ended up watching all of them at home at some point when I was growing up. And, I have a great fondness for all this. For some reason, this dumb one. Like I was saying, I think it is a wonderful farewell to the, excess of 90s action movies. It's a particular type of breed of excess, and this is, excess on top of excess. It's so good.
Two motorcycles driving right at each other.
Right at each other, and then they jump. They hit each other. Yeah.
What happens if you just assume the other guy's going to jump like you jump? What if you are the only one that goes for the jump move? You just soar over the other motorcycle. Yeah,
indeed. All right, guys, let's get to Mission Impossible 3.
Agent confirmed.
Stand by to go live. On my mark. 5.
Do you have a wife, girlfriend?
4. 3.
Whoever she is, I'm going to find her.
2.
I'm going to hurt her.
1.
And then I'm going to kill you right in front of her.
What are you not telling me?
All right, folks. Mission Impossible 3. This is kind of a game changer for the Mission Impossible franchise. Mission Impossible 2 had come out in 2000, right? And you'd expect, massively successful film. Let's definitely make a sequel right away. But it was 6 years until Mission Impossible 3 came out. And I guess Tom Cruise is busy doing other things, but he also was waiting to put an interesting spin on the franchise again.
There were some false starts, too. We hear about, what's his name? Joe Carnahan was working on, was in something. He had a script and he was in production. And then, I think Tom Cruise was like, this is not impossible enough for me.
Yeah, he said, I think it was like, this is Mission Impossible, not Mission Very Hard. You know, was the reaction to why they couldn't make, I think it was Joe Carnahan's script.
Yeah, it was Joe Carnahan's,
David Fincher at one point was slated to direct the movie. So, there's a lot of, different people, different ideas. Tandy Newton was offered to reprise her role from the previous film, but she declined.
Wouldn't that have been so cool to have her be the marriage that he's – I mean, I know the marriage was all about hiding the life from her, but still would have been so rad to have
it
that.
Just would have been a completely different movie than what we got, I think. If we, you know, and J.J. Abrams, right from the start, centers this in – I mean, Ethan Hunt's domestic life is such a dramatic difference from what it was in Mission Impossible 2. I was watching Mission Impossible 2 with my wife, and she was saying, this character in Mission Impossible 2 bears –
Yes, it's me, Jamie Lang from Made in Chelsea, and you have stumbled across the Made in Chelsea podcast. Now, I know I'm a pretty charming guy, all right? And people come up to me and go, hey, Jamie, how do you do it? And I tell them, be enthusiastic about meeting people. And most importantly, always be ready to smile. So make sure yours are looking the best with Sensodyne. It's designed to help care for sensitive teeth. The MIC Drop is proudly sponsored by Sensodyne, here for the hashtag sensitive moments on Made in Chelsea.
Absolutely no resemblance to the character we see in Mission Impossible 1 or 3. Here's a guy who's driving around the countryside, cliffside, freaking,
banging chicks, just banging chicks.
Falling in love with random women, he's reckless. in Mission Impossible yeah. 2. He's reckless. Mm-hmm. And in Mission Impossible 1, he's a lot of things, but he's not reckless. Like
he has a mother and an uncle
right?
to save.
Right. Yes, that's so true. They completely abandoned that concept, yeah. by the way.
They abandoned the concept of him having any domestic ties. Like, 2 really sticks out, not only stylistically, but in terms of the character, whatever character there is right. of Ethan Hunt. It is does not really resemble the character you see in the second film.
He is an action figure in 2.
Yeah, he's James Bond.
Yeah, he's
like old school James Bond.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
after a while, J.J. Abrams comes in and he kind of restores this franchise to its former glory. Uh-huh. And there's many different things that he does. First of all, he recruits Michael Giacchino to do the music. And let me tell you, after the Limp Bizkit of the Mission Impossible 2 theme, like Michael Giacchino, like he didn't take the theme in that many new directions, but he gave like he really kind of gave it a much more classical feel. It was very classy, is how I describe.
Yeah. Well, also Giacchino very much his style, which is very like string heavy. You know,
totally.
It's very specific to him. I think you can tell a Michael Giacchino score, you know, when you hear it. And I wonder if that's becoming a problem. Like, a lot of them are starting to sound similar. But with Mission Impossible 3, it was just, it was amazing to me watching this movie, right? Because I was a huge Alias fan. I thought J.J. Abrams was, like, a visionary. Like I thought this guy was a future blockbuster cinema. And I feel a little right there because called it. Like these movies are all Alias the movie, basically. Especially like at the beginning of 3, we get Carrie Russell, we get Felicity herself, you know, doing badass stuff, which I think maybe led to her doing The Americans too. But it is so refreshing, like just the style of it, the sharpness of it, the way the action is framed. It's very precise. It's funny. I don't think 1 and 2 are funny at all. Like 2 is intentionally funny, but 3, it really introduces the idea of like quipness and all that stuff. You know, it's all good.
Yeah, I don't know how you guys can say this isn't the best one of the franchise.
Just wait, Jeff.
Yeah. I think this one is so good, jam-packed with stuff. We get not one, but 2 of those things that I love where they're like, how can we possibly even do this? This is impossible. And then they do it. We get the bar none, hands down, best villain of the series in Philip Seymour Hoffman. The way that the movie starts with Ethan Hunt, like trying to protect his wife, and like that countdown of like Philip Seymour Hoffman, like so not caring, like dead voice, just counting down, and Tom Cruise begging him to stop, like that. And then we cut from that to like domestic life. It's just so different and bold and so interesting. True. And the action sequences are incredible. There's that, you know, that super iconic sideways blast thing that takes Tom Cruise on the bridge into the side of the car that like is so iconic. The heist into the Vatican is so smart and cool and interesting. I think this is the best one.
It's a great movie. I don't disagree. I just think like I like Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation even more. Like, and that shows how much I love this franchise, I guess. But I think like there are some things that don't quite work. I think you can kind of tell this is J.J. Abrams' first feature, and some things feel a little too hokey. I'm not a fan of that final sequence where he kind of reunites with everybody, and they're all smiling and they're all happy.
The ending is pretty rough. Like the last
two minutes,
leap in the air and freeze frame.
Yeah, literally freeze frame at the end of this movie. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
It should have cut the credits after he was like, "Yeah, I'm going on my honeymoon. Done. Movie done." I don't think
that's a minor quibble, though. I feel
it is, but it's things like that, like just little things like that spread through. I don't think I love Michelle Monaghan. I don't quite, you know, buy her in this role. It felt like they really had to force that emotional arc, and you feel that at the beginning too, because like it's all domestic life, it's all set up. Oh, they're getting married, all this great stuff. But I agree, like so much of this movie, it is completely refreshing after MI2. It is so different from so much, you know, all the spy stuff we were getting at that point. This is after Bourne Supremacy, right? So it's like it's very different. And was Casino Royale out by this point? Is that 2005?
I don't think so. I think it's after.
Yeah, it's pre-Casino Royale. So it's like, yeah, we were in this place where we had great Bourne movies, but like really cool, fun, action-packed spy movies, not really around. So I think it was refreshing in that respect. And certainly the best villain of the franchise. Like Philip Seymour Hoffman is MVP of this in terms of villainry. But when we get into the later movies, like, I think there's the set pieces are bigger and more interesting. I think you can see a lot of like that whole bridge sequence feels very green screeny now and very small compared to where the series goes. Like, they make a big deal over him jumping over a hole in the bridge, you know, and that kind of shows like how small the stakes were at this point. But yeah, the later stuff,
cool, though, how he throws the gun first. Yeah, it's so cool,
that
man.
Whole sequence is pretty fantastic. It just, to me, I think Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation just feel like bigger expressions of this idea of how you handle, you know, a big action movie.
So I love this movie, and I think there's great things about it, and I think there's things that are not good about it. One of the things I love about it is, yeah, the action is really well done. And I think J.J. Abrams is a master of understanding, and I've said this probably on the podcast many times, he's a master of understanding how to combine the practical and, you know, CG effects. I think the bridge sequence is a good one, right? That entire sequence was shot in the desert. They basically built a bridge in the middle of nowhere. J.J. Abrams was like, look, we're going to CG all the water behind the bridge. Like, I just know it's going to work. I know it's going to work. And it totally does work. Like, and that's just like, it takes a lot of faith for you to understand how like the human eye works and how you can sell something like that they're
this
in the middle.
First movie.
Yeah.
First movie ever. And to have that kind of confidence is amazing.
It is amazing. The idea that he's like, ILM is going to make this water behind the bridge and it's going to look amazing. And you're not even going to think for a second that it's all desert that we're shooting this in. It takes a lot of balls and I think he totally pulls it off.
And great special features on this one too, because you see a lot of great behind the scenes stuff on this disc with JJ, with it being his first movie, interacting, explaining how they did things, blowing up the car in the middle of the freaking Vatican, like, or, you know, like what it took to have it set up. You don't even think about it in the context of the movie, but they set off an explosion in this like historic district of Italy, of Rome, where like they had to ensure everybody that they wouldn't harm all these, you know, priceless antique buildings. A lot of really cool special features on this disc.
So I hate the ending, the last like 2 minutes of the movie, and also kind of like the lead up to it. I think Philip Seymour Hoffman, amazing actor, but I feel like this is a compliment and a disparagement of the role. I think he brought a lot to this role, meaning that there was very little there on the page for him to work with. And I think because he's such a compelling screen presence, he really made that villain work. But it's not like the best written villain character or anything like that.
Yeah.
I think when we're talking about villain characters, the only one, in my opinion, that really works is the villain from Rogue Nation. And to a lesser extent, Sean Ambrose from Mission Impossible 2.
And I think Jim Phelps works too, like as an overall.
Like, I don't know that I fully buy or understand why he wanted to betray everyone and kill everyone.
Right. Listen, he was old and the Cold War was over and he was tired. And he had a hot young wife and he was like, you know, time for a break.
I want to point out one other thing.
Hold on, let me just finish my thought and then I'll throw it over to you. But like I hate that ending, but and with all of them super happy. But the one thing I'll say about Mission Impossible 3 that I really appreciate is it is the one film that I feel is most grounded in a reality that I recognize.
Right.
You know, with him like having that dinner party at the beginning, they're announcing their wedding, and the sister gives like this emotional speech, and it's like, I feel like this guy has a family. There's like emotional stakes here that I don't really feel in any of the other films. You know,
but you know what's funny about that though is that Tom Cruise does not seem comfortable in that environment at all. Like he's so awkward, he's completely alien to having like small social gatherings. Like he's the party host that just tries too hard, and he's always like making sure you gotta make sure everybody has a drink, like all the time, like a little crazy, just a little too crazy. So I found that all hilarious. I agree, it does give the movie more emotional stakes, but that's not an area where Cruise really excelled, I guess, for me with this character.
Jeff Cannata, your thoughts?
That scene is an example of something else I want to highlight from this movie, and something else that I think J.J. Abrams does exceptionally well, which is set up some payoffs. We see in a wonderful little moment of levity how he's got this special skill where he can read lips and how that is paid off later in the movie. But that's not even the best one.
In Mission Impossible 4, we should say.
Right. It returns in Mission Impossible 4. And they don't even like reference it. It's just you just assume that you remember Ethan Hunt could do that. But the best setup and payoff in Mission Impossible 3 for my money is the defibrillator, because you have at the beginning of the movie, you have Carrie Russell, who, let's be honest, one of the most disturbing deaths ever in a movie.
Yeah.
Like those weird eyes that are not
it gets me every time.
Yeah.
It's rough. Yeah.
So disturbing. But this awesome idea that Tom Cruise is going to literally defibrillate her head to bring her back to destroy the thing in her head and kill her and then bring her back. That concept is so cool. Like there's a metal, the electric chip in my head. How are we going to get it? We're going to zap it. We're going to use a defibrillator in a way it's not supposed to be used. We're going to zap your brain. Oh my God, that would kill her. Yeah. Well, then I'll defibrillate her again and bring her back. Like, but the movie at that moment doesn't let that even happen. Like the idea is like thrown away at that point. And you think, oh my God, what a cool concept. He's going to do it. He's going to be awesome Ethan Hunt, Tom Cruise, and he's going to do it. And then the movie goes, nope, not giving that to you. That awesome idea that we just explained. And then later in the movie, we have to remember that, oh, that was just a setup for this moment where we have to, Tom has to do it to himself. And not only that, we're in a room of medical equipment. So we go, oh, he's going to defibrillator it. But the movie goes, no. No defibrillator in this medical equipment. No defibrillator.
If you don't pronounce defibrillator correct one time, I'm going to lose my mind.
Jeff's head will, Dave's head will explode.
Am I mispronouncing
as if you implanted something?
It's defibrillator.
Defibrillator. Yeah.
Defibrillator.
Yeah.
What did I say? Defibrillator.
Yeah. Some random crazy variations of that. Yeah.
Defib. Anyway, that heart thing where
defib.
They say clear.
Defib. You can call it defib.
Yeah.
That.
Sure.
You know, it's not very much like me to mispronounce something over and over like that, but I appreciate you correcting me. Anyway, you kind of derailed me. But the cool part is, like, it doesn't even exist in that medical equipment.
Yeah.
And then he has to improvise a way to do it crazy, even more crazy. Like, those series of steps of, like, here's this really cool idea. Nope, you don't get it. Oh, here it comes back later. Nope, you still don't get it. Our guy has to be MacGyver to even figure out how to do this crazy thing. Like that, I love the structure of that, and I feel like that's so JJ and so brilliant.
So agreed. JJ, I also want to shout out to Lawrence Fishburne in this movie, who I think is fantastic. Just like he has the best lines in the movie and the best delivery. It's a shame he did not come back, because I'd much rather have Lawrence Fishburne as a like smarmy government, head rather than Alec Baldwin or something.
All right. Mission Impossible 3, very strong entry into the franchise and definitely positioned this franchise for, you know, more movies that were of the same kind and also very enjoyable.
It's J.J. Abrams planting a flag, like saying this is it. And Bad Robot also, I think, took over production too. Like, so it's all under the Abrams vision, basically, going forward.
It does seem to me, though, that there's a clear delineation mark. It feels like two trilogies. Like it seems to me that number four decided, okay, these aren't going to be bespoke, unique stories. There is going to be some follow through here. And where the first movies had a couple of characters here and there that popped up, they really didn't care to establish any universe of the
other than Bing Rames. Bing Rames is eternal.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And we sort of get a little hint at what's happening, but they don't really care enough about that. And it feels like, I know you guys hate that ending with Bing Rames literally like putting two fingers in the sky and being like, yeah. but I felt like that was a clear, like, here's a happy ending for our characters. And this is sort of the end of this trilogy of movies. And then four kind of felt like it's starting this new idea of we're going to create a team, and that team is going to have things, and there's going to be stuff, you know, the end of four leads right into the beginning of five. And that it just felt like a more cohesive universe building thing.
Yeah. So let's get into our conversation about Mission Impossible 4 Ghost Protocol.
An hour ago, a bomb blew up the Kremlin. The president has initiated Ghost Protocol. The entire IMF has been disavowed. Now I've been ordered to take you to Washington, where they will hang the Kremlin bombing on you and your team, unless you were to escape after assaulting Brandt and me. But if any one of your team is caught, they will be branded terrorists out to incite global nuclear war.
So what happens now?
your mission, should you choose to accept it.
And, oh, I forgot to mention, you know, we should also say, like, Mission Impossible 3, the box office was okay. It made around $394 million worldwide, which is – or $397 million worldwide, which is the lowest in the franchise until then. But they believed in the concept. They're like, let's keep – there's something interesting here. Something interesting with continuing this set of movies, and out comes Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. My understanding is that Christopher McQuarrie actually helped to break the story of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Like, the movie was kind of in a rough state, and Christopher McQuarrie came in and helped to save it. And that's how he was able to get the directing gig for Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
Well, also Jack Reacher, too, right? So it kind of proved he could actually make a big action movie, yeah.
Yeah, and he says here about he did an uncredited rewrite of the screenplay. And he says, what I did was about clarity. The mystery had to be made simpler. It's like reaching into a sock and pulling it inside out. It's still a sock, still all the same pieces, but all put together in a different order. End quote.
That's interesting. I haven't heard that before.
Yeah.
Kind of want to dig into that now.
So, yeah, I mean, I think originally they explained a lot more about this franchise or about the story back then and before Christopher McQuarrie came on board. And we should also point out that there was like a lot of talk about Jeremy Renner's Brandt character kind of succeeding Ethan Hunt, like Ethan Hunt kind of passing the torch. I remember that being part of the conversation at the time, but
yeah,
it was the time when Jeremy Renner was going to succeed everybody.
Yeah, they wanted him as a lead in everything, and then we learned he is better as a supporting player.
Yeah, I mean, that totally did not happen at all. And in fact, his character, in my opinion, is pretty awful. Like he's
insufferable
like a,
here.
He is a wet blanket.
He's almost pointless in the movie too. He's almost superfluous.
Yeah,
he's there just to be annoying and just to like point out everything wrong that's happening. It's kind of hilarious.
Well, he's there to bridge, I think, 3 and 4 in a sort of surprising backstory reveal.
4 and 5, I think.
Mm-hmm. No. Oh, 3 and 3.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Gotcha.
It's interesting watching these movies back to back because there is an awesome Mission Impossible 3 and a half that we don't get to see. That all happens off screen, but is like an awesome awesome adventure movie of Ethan Hunt's tracking down these five terrorists and murdering them and covering it up and hiding the fact that his wife is still alive. Like, that movie would be an amazing Mission Impossible movie. And it's literally just backstory for one character in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. So Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, I love this movie, guys. I think this is my favorite one of the franchise. I think Brad Bird's proficiency with visual storytelling, he will use one shot when a normal director would use five to communicate events that are happening on screen. Mm-hmm. It has one of the all-time greatest action scenes ever put to film, right? The Burj Hotel leaping off the top of it and running connected by a cable. And the way that sequence is shot, it seems, you know, if you watch the special features on the disc, it's insane.
Did you see this movie on IMAX, by the way?
I think I saw it 3 times in theaters on IMAX because blown away.
I was reviewing movies at that time, and yeah, they screened it in IMAX, and it's quite something.
That whole sequence, like, we'll never get that back. Yeah. Like, that the full frame Burj,
you will
like,
never get that. Even in the 4K UHD, they don't even expand the frame during that sequence. No,
it's unfortunate that they don't do that. They should. And I don't want to get too far away from what you just said, Dave, which is the special features.
Yes.
This disc alone, if there's one disc to buy, it's this one, just for the behind the scenes. There's several featurettes that are great, but the behind the scenes about this sequence is so well put together and gives you a sense of how utterly bonkers that whole process was. It is absolutely bonkers what Tom Cruise did, but the entire audacity of them even attempting it and how, you know, I assumed that it, you know, we knew that Tom did a lot of the stuff and that he was out there and he did it, but I assumed there was some stuff that was faked. No, it's literally all him and literally all on the outside of the actual building in Dubai. And I mean, there's even that big leap that he does, that soaring leap, which is shot from so far away that I thought, oh, well, that's not Tom Cruise. No, it is. And he did it over and over and over again. And not only that, It took him like 2 weeks to shoot that sequence. So he's outside that building, hanging up 126 floors in the sky. 2 weeks just hanging outside a building, just doing his thing over and over and over again. It's so fascinating to watch how that was done, how many windows they had to remove, how they hung the cameras outside the windows, how many times, like even the close up stuff where he like, you know, his glove stops working and he falls. None of that was even done on the soundstage. That's literally him outside of a building 226 stories up doing a fall. It's bonkers.
It's such a great sequence. And I think, like, honestly, though, so I love the sequence completely, but rewatching it, I think this kind of shows what you were saying, Dave, like the, you know, that you just don't ask certain questions when they're going through a set piece. Like, nobody in any of those rooms were like,
no one was looking
outside my window. Yeah. What's up? What's going on here? And also, I really would have loved to see a shot like from inside, like from somebody's room, like him crying up and somebody just like hanging out in a hotel room or something. Like,
yeah. It feels like it's a missed opportunity for just one gag.
Just that one thing. But there's so many, like what you were saying, Dave, like this movie really shows how strong Brad Bird is as a visual storyteller. To me, I love this movie so much because the set pieces are fantastic, but also so much of it feels like a running, like it is practically a cartoon. There's just so much stuff happening, like the whole jailbreak sequence in the beginning. You know, there's not much dialogue happening. It's Tom Cruise communicating with, you know, with Benji through video and through hand signals. And it's things like that, like really just, you know, it's almost like watching a silent film. I feel like it's like watching a Tom and Jerry cartoon where people are just like chasing each other and like cool stuff is happening, but you can always tell what's happening. So I love all that.
The whole opening sequence, Patton. And we've got to talk about the opening sequence set to Dean Martin's Ain't That a Kick in the Head.
Amazing.
And when it's playing, you know, I don't know if you guys notice this, but the dudes are kicking the guards in the head. You guys notice that?
Yes, it is very funny. But even before that, like the very first sequence is just like, that's, I think, an even more baller opening than Mission Impossible 3, or at least just as like thrilling to me. Like just starting in media res, like Josh Holloway, he's huge in Lost. Like, you know, he just appears, has the coolest gadget we've seen in the series, just like the backwards gun firing and the parachute. Yeah. And then, gone. And just a strong opening. So I think like visually there's so much going on here in this movie. But I also think you can feel how this movie is Brad Bird's first live action movie. Like I think the characters sometimes feel a little too choreographed or too storyboarded. Like there are sequences where people are just sitting around and talking and it doesn't feel natural in a way. Like when the team's getting together after the Burge, you know, thing fails and they're arguing in a room and everyone's like posed in just a certain way.
You think it's very theatrical. It sounds
It's a little theatrical. It's not quite human. But overall, like, man, this movie kicks so much ass. If only it had a better villain.
It needs a better villain. The other thing that, you guys left out of that intro that I think is the best part of it is the diegetic, fuse.
The fuse
that has always kicked off the Mission Impossible thing.
Yeah.
Having that be like literally Tom turns to the camera and goes, light the fuse. Yeah. And then it happens and then it leads into the credit sequence. I wish that was a trope of this franchise. I wish like they had always found unique ways to light the fuse. You know, I think that would have been a cool running theme. But having it happen in this movie was such a brilliant touch.
Here's a big question for you, Jeff Cannata, is this movie has the I think it's the first one of the franchise that does the Mission Impossible tradition of showing you scenes from the rest of the film during the opening credits.
Do you
consider that trailers that for the movie?
The first movie did that.
No, I don't.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Durango,
I think Battlestar Galactica the series do that.
Yeah,
I think there's TV shows that have done that. I hate it. You know, I would hate that. But
the original Mission Impossible series did that too. So yeah.
It's not something I enjoy.
But yeah, I love the execution of the first sequence and how the music is I imagine it took some work to time the music so that it ends exactly when he gets to the bottom of the stairs like that. And right then, you know, you're in the hands of a storyteller that knows what he's doing and knows how to bring the audience along for a really wild ride.
Yeah.
The break-in of the Kremlin. I mean, you know, U.S.-Russia relations are way different now than they were back then, but still fascinating to see that gigantic gadget that they used to like project
so cool.
The hall. One thing that this is interesting about this movie is like virtually all the technology in this movie fails or doesn't work quite as intended in some way, right?
Well, it's also kind of
the running idea, the idea that they're you know, they've ghost protocoled them.
Yeah,
But I want to say something specifically about that hallway gag, which I think is brilliant and wonderful. There is something of this genre of movies, and particularly the Mission Impossible movies, but James Bond is guilty of this, and a lot of movies of this type are guilty of it. And it's something that always bugs me when they just go, "We have a gadget for that," and there's this crazy thing. Yeah, we have a gadget for that. This movie does it a couple of times. Like, there's that balloon that drops something into some place that can just hack into the system.
Yeah,
you know, just, like, there's no explanation.
Yeah, wireless server. Sure.
We have a thing for that. Or literally moments before that hallway sequence, he plugs the card reader into the card thing, and it goes, it gives him the which is visually very cool, but is that idea that it always bugs me, which is just, oh, here's this thing that's hard. No, we have the anti-hard for that.
Yeah.
You know, but moments after that, when they do the hallway gag, that's what I love, is the tech that is this crazy clever idea, that it's not just, oh, we have something that undoes what makes that hard. Instead, it's, look at this cool idea that shows how clever our team is. I mean, everything from using the like directional sound to create a dropping water droplet noise to distract the guy. That is where the heistness shines for me in these kinds of movies, is where it's like, oh my God, what a clever idea. How smart are our heroes? What a cool plan they came up with. Not just, oh, they have the undo for the thing that's hard, you know?
And what's great about that whole thing too is that they don't explain anything, right? It's just like they deploy this thing and you see, oh, a camera is reflecting what's in front. And you say, okay, so the guard doesn't think anybody's in the hallway and they can kind of push forward. But then you see the iris tracking and that deals with perspective. Then towards the end, it's like, so even if you don't get that, at the end when there are multiple people, then it's like the iris tracking is going crazy because it's only built for one person. So I kind of love all of that. You don't need to explain this stuff. Just kind of do it. And, you know, because show people using it, explain it visually. Yeah.
There's virtually no dialogue in that scene because they have to be completely quiet. Yeah. So it is a really well executed sequence. And another example, by the way, Jeff, is the device that changes the numbers on hotel hotel doors. Yeah.
We just got one of those hanging around.
Yeah. How often is that device going to come in handy? Is my question.
Yeah. I mean, I like that. There's a brilliant sequence in this movie, just conceptually, where you're seeing the same scene play out in two different rooms, and going back and forth between them, and that wonderful tension of trying to look at the pages and copy them and print them in the other briefcase. All of that is so beautifully told, and the tension is wonderful. And just from a conceptual standpoint, the idea of mirroring a meeting in real time as it's happening one floor below you, it's a cool concept.
Yeah, so many and then, cool concepts. Yeah, go ahead.
And talking about like setups and payoffs, I like how he takes the goggles with him up into the Burj climbing. Jeremy Renner points out the goggles, like, "Hey, goggles, take them off." And then later he uses them to track down the guy during the dust storm. You know, like super cool.
Always good to have goggles. We haven't talked much about Paula Patton, by the way, but I thought she is fantastic in this movie.
So great.
Yeah.
So like she definitely is giving me a lot of Jennifer Garner vibes in this movie. I think I mentioned this when we reviewed it. But it's like seeing her and seeing Tandy Newton in these movies really makes me wish like they brought back more characters. Cause I do, and Maggie Q in Mission Impossible 3. Like, there's so many great characters that we've encountered throughout this franchise, and they keep trying to throw new ones at us, and some of them work, some of them don't. It is nice to see people returning in Fallout. But I want more Paula Patton. I want her doing more action, stuff like this.
She's great. She's so good.
Agreed completely. I got to defend the villain character in this movie a little bit. And that is because it is the first villain character in these movies that really, truly has he's bonkers and like this.
Yeah.
This character is insane. What I mean by that is not just literally, which he is, but I mean also Hey, he's a professor of game theory who mm-hmm. used to be ex-Special Forces, and that's why he can fight Tom Cruise. And by the way, he wants to launch nuclear warheads at, you know, major cities and destroy yeah. them all. But at least he has an, you know, say what you will about the tenets of National Socialism, at least it's an ethos. Like, at least this guy had an idea about, yeah. like, there's an idea, like, he's an insane supervillain, but he, at least I understand why someone would feel that way. Do you know what I mean?
And yet,
I guess.
I don't agree with his philosophy at all, but at least he has a philosophy, you know?
But he's an empty vessel is the thing. But yeah, go ahead.
Dave, he's also stupid enough to, when he's getting away, he'll take off the mask and throw it on the ground for Ethan Hunt to find the mask
yeah.
and realize who – like. At what point – he's literally had this entire crazy chase wearing a mask. And the moment he gets away, he not only takes the mask off to reveal his identity, but then throws it down for Ethan Hunt yeah. to find?
Well, Ethan Hunt pulled off a piece of the mask. So I think he figured it out. Like towards the end of that chase, like they had a tussle.
But he could have been anyone. He could have been anyone still. Yeah. You know, I think it is a really weird – like it's kind of shot and edited to feel like a big reveal. But then at the end you're like, oh, it's just the guy that worked for him. You know, like
I do feel like that may be one of the things that got switched up in editing or however this movie was kind of reframed. But I have to say the best thing about the villain for me is like the way they he explains what he's doing in like a, you know, a talk while other things are happening. So if you're paying attention to like Tom Cruise's dialogue, you know, it's just like mission setup or something. But then you're hearing this crazy philosophy is like, oh, yeah, we should just destroy the world because that makes complete sense.
Yeah. It's very Thanos-esque, you know.
Yeah, he's committed enough that he's just going to take a header off the top of that car thing.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I have a kind of a problem with that car.
I don't like that entire car thing.
I love it. Like, I think it's awesome.
It felt like somebody looked at that and went, you know, nobody's ever done an action sequence in that.
Yeah.
You know, and it just feels so contrived.
Maybe it just felt like a little too much after we had so much good stuff in this movie. But yeah, it's a little contrived. And then I'm not a fan of villains jumping to their death. That's fine. That shows how comedic he is. Not a fan of Ethan Hunt's plan. I'm just going to get in this. Make sure you see it's a BMW and you know how safe BMWs are. Get in this BMW and just do a header off this thing, which, yeah, I don't know. There's so many dumb things he's done, and that seems among the dumbest in the entire series.
Well, it all worked out, so I think it was proven to not be dumb. I'm just going to point that out there. I mean, I really like that sequence. I think, hey, we just had this Burj Hotel sequence. We got to top it somehow. We can't do something bigger, so we're going to do something more intricate, and I appreciate
it. Is that topping it? I don't know.
I don't think it's topping it, but it's at least like coming close. It's like at least we're going to put a ton of love and care into how intricate and how, you know, complex this action scene is.
It is very intricate. It feels like a platforming video game level or something like that. That's kind of what's happening there. But also the Burj thing, like what makes that so cool is it's very evocative of that space. And that's a thing that actually, you know, exists there in Dubai. And they go to Mumbai and barely, you know, they have a party in Mumbai. But I feel like a nice action sequence using the insanity of that city could have been more interesting. Interesting.
And then literally you have the law enforcement guy that's been on his tail finding him and being like, Oh, it's all a misunderstanding. I guess I'm fine with you breaking my nose.
Yeah. I will say this other thing about Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, which is I think this movie was made in 2011, and I think it's the first film in the Mission Impossible series where we still in present day have not caught up with the technology in this movie yet.
Sure.
I don't think you could say for the other films. I mean, I think even like we're 7 years out, but I don't think like 7 years after Mission Impossible 1, I think we had caught up with the technology in Mission Impossible 1. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, the glass, the big thick black glasses that have a camera in them.
I think when that like screen comes down from the side of the train car and he puts the thumb drive on it and it scans the thumb drive automatically, I still geek out about that. I think that was a Microsoft concept. Yeah,
the way it slides down from the wall is so rad.
Yeah, it is it's awesome.
For me, I still geek out over that BMW, that concept i8, which I believe they sold, but just not with that insane UI.
The touchscreen in the windshield, right?
Yeah. Which is not good. You don't want a touchscreen on your windshield, granted, but it looks so cool.
Yeah, it does. So cool. It does. So any other thoughts about Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol? I think we all think it's a really solid entry into the franchise. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's my favorite one out of all of them. It does not have the best script, which, in my opinion, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation has probably the best script, but it does have the best filmmaking in my perspective. So
I think the best set pieces or
yeah, exactly.
I don't know.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
You guys hated.
I actually like the set pieces in Rogue Nation more too. So it's just the way it's filmed. Like to me, it also feels like, oh, I want more Incredibles style action, and you kind of get that immediately too. So really fascinating watching this movie after Incredibles 2,
yeah,
where we got even crazier set pieces from Bad Bird.
Yeah.
The way you guys disliked the ending of 3, how did you feel about the ending of 4? You know, I mean, it's basically the same thing. Well, let's all sit around and yep, be happy yep with each other.
Well, at least
at least they're not at the IMF, you know. And like, why would they let in Ethan Hunt's wife? And anyway, yeah. It just
but also.
Like, nice to see Ving Rhames. That's
cool
all.
Cool to see Ving Rhames. Did you like seeing the wife across the way moment?
That again shows how inhuman Tom Cruise is. Like, are you just stalking her? Like, you just yes go there and watch her hang out with her work friends, and she has to smile and wave at you. Otherwise, like, she knows you know her life is in your hands at this point. It is a very creepy thing. Like, Tom Cruise cannot even leave change when he's eating out like a normal human being. Like, go look at that. He just kind of like flips it, kind of like flings it on the table. It's kind of amazing. He can't do normal human things. It's just hilarious.
There's a scene. I can't remember which movie. I think because they're all, I watched them all back to back. I think it was 3 when he is walking. No, maybe it is 4. When he's walking. It's definitely 4 because he's got the hoodie on. He steals a hoodie and he steals shoes, and then he steals a cell phone, and he uses the cell phone. And then when he's done using the cell phone, he casts it into a tiny hole in the sidewalk, but doesn't break stride. And it's a clean throw. And I wondered, did they do that 400 times to get it right? Is it CG, or is Tom Cruise just good at doing shit like that? You know,
Speaking of stuff that Tom Cruise is good at doing, I like the, one of the best transformations is when he's walking out of the Kremlin and he like rips off the jacket and the mustache.
Badass. And the jacket goes inside out.
Yeah. That's like, I mean, when I think back to the Mission Impossible franchise, I think of like key moments. You guys were talking about jumping across the bridge and throwing the gun and in Mission Impossible 3. And like, him doing that transformation in Mission Impossible 4, Burj Hotel stuff. Like these like super clever moments that just stick out of my memory. That's one of them. And Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol had a ton. So, okay, let's get to the last film in the franchise, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation.
The IMF is uniquely trained and highly motivated. Specialist without equal, immune to any countermeasures. But it is an agency of chaos.
The time has come to dissolve the IMF.
Now, I want you to choose your next words very carefully. Where is Hunt?
Last I heard, he was tracking the syndicate.
How come the CIA has never discovered any intel regarding this syndicate?
You want the polite answer or the truth?
So as we pointed
out before the next film,
that's right. So as we pointed out, this one is directed by Christopher McQuarrie.
And written by Christopher McQuarrie. The first time it's been like written, directed by, Brad Bird didn't write his. So
yeah.
It's kind of funny.
Ethan and team take on their most impossible mission yet, eradicating the Syndicate, an international rogue organization as highly skilled as they are, committed to destroying the IMF. What do you guys think of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation?
I love this movie. I love this movie completely. This is my favorite movie of the franchise because I think, like, I really like Ghost Protocol. I love Mission Impossible 3, but it's like we've seen so many of these movies. Where can we go from here? And the answer is you go to Christopher McQuarrie and you go to Rebecca Ferguson. And just like, this movie is astounding on many levels. It's nice to have a spy buddy who can actually match, Ethan Hunt toe-to-toe. Her character, I love Ilsa Faust. I love everything about like what they're doing with her and how they're teaming up and their love and hate relationship. It may just be me, because I remember as a kid, I watched Batman Returns a lot, and I watched that movie so much. I was like, what is this dynamic, this Batman and Catwoman dynamic? I'm really into this. I don't know what's going on. So yeah, that was fun in this. The set pieces are just insane. Like the birch climbing, everything is great. And certainly insane on another level too. But I think the way the diving sequence is shot, like I can't so breathe properly. Yeah, when I'm watching that. And then like how that transitions from, you know, he's dead, he gets up. It's very self-aware. I was like, I think this movie is the most self-aware of the entire franchise of like Tom Cruise's size and kind of how tired he gets and maybe he's getting a little old. Like it's all kind of like referenced in the movie. But that after the diving sequence, like it transitions into a car chase and then transitions into a motorcycle chase and the best chase of the entire franchise. And I love chases and the motorcycle stuff just looks beautiful. There's just the entire opera sequence, which is that is just one of my personal favorite action set pieces in general, just set to the music. Rebecca Ferguson and her outfit and the kind of way that entire thing is constructed. I love so much of this movie because I think it just pushes forward what the franchise can be. Using the recording, the assignment recording against him at the beginning, you know, stroke of genius and a really ice cold villain. I don't think he's charismatic in the way that Sean Ambrose is or something, but he's very, very evil. Like he gets the evil thing down. Not a great villain, but I think much better than what we've seen in the franchise. So just like overall, I love everything about this. I think I'm just a big fan of Christopher McQuarrie, especially what he did with Jack Reacher too. Yeah, like it's just good stuff.
He elevated Jack Reacher from kind of a pulpy serialized, mm-hmm. what could have been very pulpy and serialized, into, because of how stylish it was, something that transcended its genre, in my opinion. One thing that this movie does well, first of all, love the villain character. And one thing this movie does well is the sequence at the end when Benji has all the bomb stuff strapped to him. And uh-huh. You're thinking, yeah, like, this. A, it's very rare for an IMF agent to feel like they're actually in genuine danger in these movies, but like it's actually very emotional. Like he's fearing for his life,
and he has to say the words. He has to say the
words, yeah. Yeah. Like it's a very intense. And you're thinking to yourself, like, how is he going to get out of this? And he eventually gets out of. I don't know that I completely buy it. He's like, hey, here's $50 million. But there's
here's
like
one number I memorized. Now you have to believe I memorized them all. Yeah.
Well, but he's like, here's $50 million. But you, in order to get access to the 4 billion or however many billion, you know, you need my brain. And, you know, if I was the bad guy, I'd just be like, okay, 50 million is enough. Goodbye. You know, like, I think that's enough money for me to do all the evil things.
You cannot run a criminal syndicate with that amount.
Yeah. No. That's why you're not a criminal mastermind, Dave. Yeah,
it's true.
Your sights are too low.
That's exactly correct.
I also think Simon Pegg is an unsung hero across all the movies he's in. Mm-hmm. He's consistently so great and, you know, makes other people shine by being comic relief and being sort of reactionary to all the craziness. He's sort of the everyman cipher that we get, you know, get to be in those situations with.
But also being Q, yeah.
Yeah, it also gets to be, right, it also gets to be a little bit of Q. Yeah, the other sequence that I love in this movie is the box, putting the bad guy in the box. It's so clever and so cool and such a great, like, you know, master stroke, super team kind of way of trapping someone. It's such a neat sequence. But I totally agree with you, Devendra, that the motorcycle chase – It's awesome to go like, oh, we've already done a motorcycle chase in this franchise, but let's just completely one up it and do something even so much cooler and crazier. This is a great movie, and I think it shows that 6 movies in, this franchise hit its stride. You know, it's pretty wild to say that.
You mean five movies in?
Excuse me, 5 movies in. Yeah, 5 movies in.
But maybe we will say that in a few weeks, Jeff.
I like you, Dave, I'm highly anticipating this one, and I feel like these movies are as sure a bet as you get in sequential franchises at this point. Like, I know that I'm so confident I'm going to like it. You know, I know what this movie has found its identity and feels like it delivers what I want out of it. And that's crazy to say, you know, 5-6 movies in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, the fastest turnaround between sequels we've ever seen. The first time, like, the same person is, you know, writing and directing the next one. Like, a lot of good signs, but I don't want to like get too hopeful. As great as that trailer is, because I remember Spectre, I remember Jason Bourne, I remember The Dark Knight Rises. So we'll see.
Sure. All good examples of like same director. You know.
Yeah.
and really underwhelming follow-up. So yeah, it could go badly. But I think Jeff points out that, yeah, this is a very reliable franchise. And one of the things that's reliable about it is you know you're going to see some really good stunts. And that's just I don't at all – when I watch Avengers Infinity War, I don't for a second believe any of those people were even remotely in danger when they were filming this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And I'm not saying you need to – like Tom Cruise needs to almost die for this – you know, but this is a guy who by his own choice is putting himself in extremely dangerous, visually spectacular situations for the American public. And it shows on screen. Like you can tell that someone's actually doing this and this is not all green screen. And that is really compelling. And in a kind of all visual effects digital world, this is still, despite being a very highly technologically, you know, involved franchise, this is still a very analog kind of franchise where you can you can see all the work that goes into doing these set pieces in a way that you can't with other major blockbusters. It's great counter programming in today's crowded cinema landscape that's very VFX heavy. So
and in the same week where we literally got news that Disney has developed robot stunt people. You know what I mean? It's like we're getting farther and farther away from a human being, and it seems almost a crass thing to say. I want a human being to risk their life for my entertainment, but it is spectacular to know that Tom Cruise was hanging outside that building or hanging onto that plane. It really does add to the tension and majesty of those scenes.
We were talking about how Mission Impossible 2 has one of the best lines of the franchise, but this also, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, also has an amazing monologue.
Yes.
When Alec Baldwin, at the end of the film, right, they're trying to figure out how he's going to attack the Prime Minister, and he says, quote, "Hunt is uniquely trained and highly motivated, a specialist without equal, immune to any countermeasures. There is no secret he cannot extract, no security he cannot breach, no person he cannot become. He has most likely anticipated this very conversation and is waiting to strike in whatever direction we move. Hunt is the living manifestation of destiny, and he has made you his mission, Prime Minister."
I mean, it's basically, you can say the same thing about Tom Cruise. It works for both people.
It is like that line, the way he delivers it too, it is so ridiculous and over the top, but it is also amazing, you know?
Yeah. So good. I mean, it really shows his commitment. Like, you know, this entire show has felt like a Tom Cruise love fest because this is his like signature franchise and everything. Personally, I think he is a, you know, I love watching him as a movie star. As I pointed out, I don't know how he functions as a person, because the time he has to do person things in these movies, it is not quite human. It's like a Westworld robot going off its programming or something. So there is that. But I appreciate his commitment to this craft, at least.
Yeah, for sure. And also we talked about how awesome Rebecca Ferguson is, but the relationship that develops between them two is kind of interesting. They're kind of nemeses, but also friends and
frenemies,
right? And I'm really curious what the continuity is going to be between this film and the next film. Like, how is the next film going to evolve their relationship, right? So that this movie sets that up, I think, really well. And I'll be curious to see how the next film, what direction the next film takes it.
This movie is so well written. Her entire, like, come away with me speech, like, came it. That is one of the surprises. Like, I wasn't expecting that the first time I saw this movie. It's just so, it is so sharp and so evocative, and shows, like, it also hints at, like, something we can see that Ethan Hunt kind of wants, right? He wants to escape this hellish life. He couldn't even have a normal, you know, relationship. You know, it's like that prospect of just running away and being free is kind of romantic to him, whereas I think a normal person would think being a super agent is pretty romantic. So I love her speech. I kind of love, everything they built up. Hopefully they don't just drop her and forget about her, because that's what they've done with this entire franchise with all the romantic leads.
I have a feeling, you know, I have not watch the trailer, but I have heard the trailer with my eyes
closed.
She's
in the movie.
And she's in the movie. So I'm curious to see how that's going to work out. We were talking about tech for the last movie. Really love the tech from this movie. The e-ink laptop that's like looks like an opera program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just saw one of those, by the way, at Computex this year. So e-ink is not dead. It is still a thing. You know,
the refresh rate on that thing was super high. You know?
So bad. It's so bad.
But the tech, you know, the suit that tells you how much oxygen you have in your, you know, anyway.
The gun that's a flute, I think.
I, so I think one of the – as we're looking – you know, as we're wrapping up here, the plots of these movies have never got less ridiculous.
Right.
And, you know, that is a bit of a challenge. The whole plan was we're going to send three assassins after this guy. And then, by the way, we have a suitcase bomb as insurance in case none of those work out. It just feels like, wow, the syndicate is extremely well funded and has, like, planned a backup plan for the
IMF. They're better. They make better decisions than the IMF, probably, right?
Yeah, I guess most certainly. they've always been absolutely ridiculous, these films. And, like, the plots never get more plausible. And I guess the movies aren't really concerned with that. It's just concerned with being as over-the-top as possible. And, I think I've basically accepted that. So
yeah, yeah.
Any other thoughts on Rogue Nation?
A quick mention of some of the Blu-ray stuff. It is nice that this one, Rogue Nation, has Dolby Atmos support. So if you have that surround sound, it's very nice to see. I'm kind of disappointed that Ghost Protocol, which has a really nice Atmos mix, I actually went to Dolby's offices here in New York, and like the entire like sand car chase sequence, like the sandstorm sequence, that was a major Atmos demo for them. Yeah. So that's one. It's a shame that we didn't get that in like the best version of the movie we have so far.
Yeah. Another random thing I just want to point out is, like, I found this film to be kind of – Rebecca Ferguson's character was almost a response to Bryce Dallas Howard's character in Jurassic World. I think these movies came out the same summer, if I'm not mistaken, right? And how there's that one scene where she's running and she, like, hands Tom Cruise her shoes. And she's like
– And shoes, please. Yeah, she has him take them off. Yeah,
she's like, shoes, please. And he just, like, he's like, doesn't understand. And she's like, shoes, please. And she says it again more insistently.
And he comments on her shoes in their first scene, too. Like, it's kind of funny.
Yeah. But it just is a subtle sign of, like, how competent that character is. And and kind of, I love the sequence how they rappel down the side of the building as well. Is really well done.
This entire series, I think, has done a good job focusing on shoes in general. Like, I love, one of my favorite moments in Ghost Protocol is when, like, Paula Patton finally has a chance to, like, take down the woman who murdered her man, and like she just kicks off those heels and goes running.
Right.
And it's like that's exactly what you want from the series.
Yeah. I do have one extremely minor disappointment with this movie, which is that the and it's not even really a disappointment. It's just kind of, I guess, a difference is that the most spectacular stunt of him hanging off the side of the plane, it is tangentially related to the rest of the plot.
Yeah, right.
But it doesn't. Yeah. It's not like I was thinking like the movie would build up to that, and it kind of just uses that scene in the first 5 minutes and kind of almost unrelated throwaway gag.
Yeah.
So. That's something the other movies haven't done as much, and I'll be curious to see how the new movie handles Tom Cruise's stunts as well.
It's weird how it's not related to much of anything. I also don't like the way it ends. It feels like it ends and cuts to the fuse at a point where I kind of want to see is he just flying
next?
Out there with this thing? Yeah, what goes on? Like, where's his parachute? Is he just holding onto this thing for dear life? Like, I feel like there was another moment I would have loved to see.
Yeah, Jeff Cannata, you want to bring it home for us?
Well, this is a series that I really enjoy. I'm very excited for Fallout. I would rate these movies as follows.
Yes, let's rank them. Rank. Yep.
Yes. 3, 4, 5, 1, 2. So that would be Mission Impossible 3, Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, and then the first mission, and then the first Mission Impossible, and then far behind is Mission Impossible 2, which is still fun in a very campy way, but I don't think holds with the rest of the series for me.
Devendra,
I think mine is pretty much backwards at this point. It is 5, 4, 3, 1, 2. Like, and I, you know, 2 is definitely the worst of the series on many levels, but I was shocked how much fun I had with it. Honestly, still.
I am kind of in the middle of you guys. I am 4, 5, 1, 3, 2. So Ghost Protocol, Rogue Nation, number one, and then MI3, and then Mission Impossible 2. Yeah.
I can't believe you have 3 that low. That's crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, I really feel like 1 has stood the test of time. Like,
yeah.
I really feel like there's more substance to 1 in terms of those characters than there is in 3. 3 is exceptionally well-made action film, one of my favorite of all time, but it just, like, when I look at 1 and I look at 3, I'm like, which one is like which one of like in 30, 40 years from now, I think is going to be a more substantial contribution to cinema. I think it's going to be one. You know,
I don't know. Like the J.J. Abrams School of Filmmaking has been everywhere.
Yeah,
he's taken over Star Trek. He's taken over Star Wars. Like it's
fair enough.
I'm very proud of my guy. Yeah, he's so good.
All right, guys, let's wrap it up. You can find more episodes of the show at slashfilmcast.com. Email us. Let us know what you thought of not the Slash Filmcast, but that too, of Mission Impossible at slashfilmcast@gmail.com. Stay tuned to hear what we'll be reviewing next week. In the meantime, Jeff Cannata, where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
Well, you can always follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with two N's and one T. And I do a video game show every week called DLC. You can find that at 5by5.tv/DLC.
How about you, Devendra Hardwar?
Oh, I'm on Twitter at Devendra and write about tech at engadget.com.
Find all my stuff at davechen.net. I also just did a review of Stubbs A-List, which you can find at flashfilm.com and on my YouTube channel at youtube.com/DaveChensky. We can talk more about that during next week's episode of the podcast.
I just signed up for that. I'm very excited to use it.
Yeah, yeah. So we can talk more about it next week. And speaking of next week, Christy Puchko is going to return to join us for our review of Ant-Man and the Wasp. So look forward to that. Thanks for listening really appreciate it. Guys, I had a lot of fun diving into these movies, guys.
So fun.
Thanks for listening. Hope you guys enjoyed it as well in the audience. We'll see you next week. We watch the movies, flicks, tracks for the good, bad. It's the Slash Film Cast. For all the news and the movies coming out, because you know that it's the thing worth talking about.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.